It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, with the Syrian civil war entering its fifth year, we take a look at the decisions the Obama administration has made, from a chemical weapons red line to airstrikes against the militant group ISIS.
First, we're talking about news that Republican state lawmakers are planning to fast-track a bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks in Wisconsin. The lead sponsor of the bill, State Senate President Mary Lazick, says she hopes to see a vote on the proposal as soon as possible.
Mary Spacuzza is with us to talk about the bill and how it could change abortion access here in the state. She's a politics and breaking news reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mary, before we get into exactly what this legislation does, the fast track is a new part of this. What does it mean when we say that Republicans are trying to fast track this bill?
Well, it was introduced late last week, and it could be scheduled for a vote in committee very, very quickly and then head to the floor. And Governor Walker has said he would sign the bill.
And there was some thought that this and a lot of other pieces of legislation might be on the back burner until after the state budget process was done. That appears to not be the case now?
That does not appear to be the case. And Governor Walker actually, I think it was back in March in Milwaukee, he said that he believed state lawmakers could kind of handle both at the same time. So deal with the budget, but also take up this bill. And it looks like that's what they're planning to do.
So we've heard that this bill bans almost all abortions effectively after 20 weeks. The sponsor of the legislation on the assembly side was on with us a while back. So give us the details. What would this bill do?
Yes, it would ban any abortions after 20 weeks. It would not include exemptions for, say, victims of rape or incest. It would include an exemption if the life of the mother was in immediate danger, but it would not if, say, she had, you know, it caused medical problems for her. So unless she was essentially at risk of immediately dying, there would be no exemption.
So what have supporters said is the need for this, the Republican sponsors of this bill?
They've actually framed it in the context of fetal pain and said that studies show that a fetus can feel pain at 20 weeks and therefore should not be subjected to an abortion that late stage in the pregnancy. Proponents of abortion rights have said that fetuses likely cannot feel pain until far later, probably about 27 weeks or in close to the third trimester. And they are saying that this is essentially a move to restrict abortion rights and is not about fetal pain.
And that pain issue is one that you could dig way deep into. But in your reporting, you say each side points toward different medical research on that issue.
Right. Yeah, there's been research saying that fetuses are very unlikely to have ability to feel pain until the third trimester. The advocates of this bill point to a study from, I believe it was 2007, saying that even if a child doesn't have a cerebral cortex developed yet, that fetus could still feel pain. However, I believe that the author of that study that they typically cite said that was not the intention of his study to prove that they could feel pain. So I think it's kind of both sides pointing to different studies that find different things. And I think it very much comes down to ideology and what people believe.
Mary Spacuzza is with us. She's with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talking about legislation in the legislature restricting abortions after 20 weeks into a pregnancy. Mary, how many Republicans so far are backing this bill that we know of?
Quite a few. I believe that there are now at least 30 co-sponsors of the bill. Obviously, Senate President Mary Lazick is a major supporter. This is an issue near and dear to her heart, so she's clearly promoting this bill and eager to get it to the floor for a vote.
And you've mentioned what some pro-choice groups are saying. What are we hearing from Democrats in the legislature about the proposal?
You know, Democrats are saying that this is just another way to restrict abortion rights. They're saying this is not about pain. This is about taking away choices for women. They're pointing to a lot of women get an ultrasound around 20 weeks. You might find out at that point what the gender is, whether it's a boy or a girl. And there have been cases, it doesn't sound like many, but, you know, possibly as many as 100 in Wisconsin each year, where that ultrasound may detect, they call it a fatal fetal anomaly or a problem in the development of the fetus that makes it look like it really will not be able to live. And they're pointing to that, saying, you know, this is a woman who really wants to be pregnant, who's gotten this far, and then discovers that the fetus could be born and live a very short and painful life.
And again, that's not exempted in this law, that situation.
That is not. Fatal fetal anomalies or serious health problems do not exempted. It would only be if the life of the mother was in immediate danger.
Now, you mentioned legislators hoping to get this into committee and the full legislature for votes soon. The governor has said he would sign it. That still leaves another step, potentially. Similar laws in other states blocked by courts. Do you think this would be challenged in courts? What would the prospects be for it there, from what we know now, Mary?
I think it would be most certainly challenged in court, either by Planned Parenthood or a group like that, or, you know, a citizen backed by someone like that. I think that it would certainly be challenged in court. You know, it has been held up in courts in other states. I think there are now 13 states who ban abortions after 18 to 20 weeks, but certainly a judge might block it and just say that even though it's passed, it is not going to be enforced.
A lot of what happens here in Wisconsin. From the national perspective, people have the presidential race in mind. Governor Walker says, yes, he'll sign it. Do you think this could affect his potential presidential ambitions?
I think he would, if he does sign a bill like this, I think it would certainly bolster and win support for him among Republican caucus voters. There are a lot of social conservatives who don't agree with abortion at all, much less late-term abortions. And so I think if he signed this, you would certainly hear him talking about this on the stump ahead of his likely run.
So we've used the phrase as soon as possible. That's when legislators are hoping to get this into committees. Do you have a sense of what kind of timeline we could be seeing, how soon it could be up for votes in the full chambers?
I would say very soon.
All right.
I don't know if it'll necessarily make it to committee this week, and maybe it's been scheduled so far and I just haven't seen, but I would not be surprised if this was heading to the floor in the very near future.
Mary, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Mary Spacuzza, politics and breaking news reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about news that Republican state lawmakers are planning to fast-track a bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks. By the way, you can hear more coverage of this issue on the Joy Cardine Show tomorrow morning after 8.
The Syrian civil war is now entering its fifth year. The death toll is above 200,000 and 6.5 million people have been displaced. Meanwhile, the militant group ISIS has emerged and expanded in both Syria and Iraq.
Beginning early in the conflict, various members of President Obama's cabinet and lawmakers called for American military intervention. The president decided against it. Later, the president said the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons was the red line which would trigger U.S. military intervention. A new Frontline documentary called Obama at War takes a look at that moment and beyond.
Obama's having second thoughts. He's feeling alone. His friends in Britain say, yes, we're with you, but then Parliament says, no, we're not.
It is clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that, and the government will act accordingly.
When the Islamic State, known as ISIS, directly threatened the U.S. last year, the president announced airstrikes against the group and allocated funds to train rebel fighters. Some say the president should have acted earlier. Others say it made sense to stay out of the fight. Frontline investigates those arguments in Obama at War. It airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station. Producer and reporter Martin Smith joins us now. Martin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So in the early days of the Syrian civil war, did the Obama administration see any reason for the U.S. to intervene?
Well, I think they saw no reason to get involved initially because everybody in the region and all the observers in the United States, practically everyone, thought that Assad was going to fall in a matter of weeks, if not months, maybe months. But he looked like his days were numbered. We'd seen the fall of the dictator in Tunisia as well as Mubarak stepping down in Egypt. And so it just didn't seem, it seemed like he was going to be gone. very quickly. So they didn't do anything at that point, but they did, the president went forward and said, you know, it's time for him to leave.
And as the U.S. watched, as events unfolded, did the U.S. have the problem of wondering, well, if the U.S. got involved, who should we back?
It was a very difficult set of choices facing the administration, and that's what we try to outline in the program. There's a lot of criticism from the Syrian so-called moderate or pro-Western opposition that says that because we didn't help them, they dwindled in number and the extremists were able to gain a foothold and eventually become dominant. But when the president was looking out at this, he didn't see reliable partners. It wasn't as clear as people would have you believe that there were moderates who were model of the kind of army that we would want to support. And there was also the question of, if you give them arms, what if those arms end up in the hands of an al-Qaeda-linked group? Or if the group is successful, let's say, and they topple Assad, who's going to replace him? Our record in the Middle East of toppling dictators, whether it's Gaddafi or Hussein, have not been, our record is not very good. So there were a lot of legitimate questions that the president was dealing with, although most of his national security cabinet members were in favor of giving arms to the rebels, to getting skin in the game, if you will.
And it sounds as though, as the civilian death toll began to rise, one question that was on the table with the administration was, is Syria another Rwanda? Is it the Balkans? How did the administration try to answer that question?
Well, very good point. And in the president's inner circle was Samantha Power, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. And she was saying to the president, look, you don't want to act, but there are consequences, you know, to not acting here. Finally, the president listened to her, listened to others, but decided to stay out. He didn't think he had reliable partners, was worried about the consequences of getting involved, and of course the American people didn't want to be involved here. And even though there were some people on Capitol Hill calling for us to create, safe havens for the rebels, the majority of people in Congress were not in favor of getting America involved in another Middle Eastern war.
And then came the famous press conference where Chuck Todd threw a question to the president, and the president came up with the use of chemical weapons as a red line. How did that come out?
Well, it didn't go down very well with his aides, who were surprised that he said it. It wasn't as if he went to a press conference and gave a statement. It was a question at the end of a press conference about other things, Medicare and Afghanistan and whatnot, that this question came up, and the president is improvising at this point. And he says, well, if he uses chemical weapons, that would be a red line for us. If he does that, if there's movement on the chemical weapons front, there will be, quote-unquote, enormous consequences. So now the president has painted himself into a corner, because now if Assad doesn't back down, what is the president going to do? And we track very carefully those moments as the tension mounted over just what was the United States going to do.
And Assad didn't back down, at least not on the chemical weapons. They were used, and that red line had been crossed. So as you saw it in the documentary, what unfolded next?
Well, he repeatedly pushed the limits to testing the president. The president then orders the military to get ready. Ships move into the eastern Mediterranean. The missiles are loaded. We're all ready to go. The strike is set for August 31st. This is 2013. And then on a Friday night, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military authority in the country, General Dempsey, gets a phone call from the president. He describes it, and he says, look, our finger was on the trigger, but I got a phone call. He told me to stand down. The president then conferred with his chief of staff, and they decided, in order to get political cover, they would take this decision to strike or not to strike to Congress. Well, that surprised his aides as well, because going to Congress, it was pretty clear that he was most likely not going to get backing. So it's a dramatic sequence in the middle of the documentary The outcome of that is finally that in another offhand remark by Secretary of State Kerry, he's asked a question and asked, how can Assad avoid a military strike? This was presuming that Congress would even approve it. He said, well, he could just give up his chemical weapons. And then he says, but he's not going to do it. So, you know, he just sort of tossed it off. Well, the Russian foreign minister, chief ally to the Syrian regime, took that up and went to his counterpart, the foreign minister of Syria, and got Assad, the dictator, to agree. And it was diffused at the 11th hour without striking. But but there were even consequences to that.
We're talking about the new Frontline documentary, Obama at War. You can catch it tonight at 9 o'clock on your local public TV station. And we're talking with producer and reporter Martin Smith right now. And to look a little more closely at that moment when the U.S. didn't intervene after that red line had been crossed, as someone puts it in the documentary, he blinked. What do you know about what happened to turn him in that moment?
Well, he didn't have political cover. And as the clip that you ran at the top of this segment, he was feeling alone. He knew that Prime Minister Cameron in England was not getting the backing of his parliament, so the English were not going to come on board with this operation. People were backing off. He didn't feel that he had the political cover. And keep in mind that always this is a president who promised not to start wars, but to end wars. And so that weighs heavily, and he, I believe, takes that as seriously or more seriously than anything, than any other promise that he's made. So at the 11th hour, he blinks because he decides that he's not going to go forward with this unless he has sufficient political cover, which he didn't really have.
And so after this, we see the rise of ISIS. ISIS emerges, and eventually the president decides it is time to call for airstrikes. What got us to that point where the U.S. is then ready to intervene?
ISIS took advantage of the decision of the United States not to intervene, and they said to the Syrian people, and they said, the United States doesn't have your back. You know, the president made a threat, then he doesn't carry it through. So if you want protection from Assad, from the dictator, and all these atrocities, you know, we'll protect you. And so that gained them some credence. But when they moved into Mosul in northern Iraq, came out of Syria into Mosul, and were expanding their territory, you know, seemingly an unstoppable force last summer, the president felt compelled to act. And so he began to try and help push them back. But still, he doesn't want to put U.S. troops on the ground. And so running a successful campaign against a group like ISIS from the air, if you don't have reliable partners on the ground, is a tall order.
How did ISIS gain such momentum when really Assad had been the big target for Syrian opposition all along?
Well, they were among the groups. Well, let's back up a little bit. The group that we now call ISIS, its roots are in Iraq. It's the old Al-Qaeda in Iraq that we, the United States, was fighting back when troops were there back in 2006, 7, 8. That group was pretty much decimated by 2011 when the United States left, but they move into Syria, where this civil war is going on, and there's a lot of open spaces that they can exploit, and they get oil wells, and they have an extortion racket going. And as Assad is more brutal, they gain sort of a credibility in their own brutality because they're willing to stand up to that kind of atrocity. By dishing out atrocities of their own against Assad's forces or against other rebel groups. And eventually, many of the moderates who haven't received much aid from the West are discouraged. They either quit or they join with extremist groups like the Al-Qaeda group or in some cases, ISIS. So ISIS grows while the rest of the moderate opposition dwindles.
And one question that you tackle as we wrap up here, what if the president had bombed Syria in the early days when that red line was crossed? Would we still have seen this rise of ISIS?
You know, that's the experiment that we don't have, you know, we don't have a control group in the experiment here. There's no alternative reality in which we could see what would happen. And I think it's an open question. I don't think necessarily that that would have changed. I think you could make a better argument that getting involved earlier, aggressively, diplomatically in the region, and perhaps in arming the rebels might have made a difference. But even there, I think it's a very hard call. I don't think, you know, this was an interesting documentary to make because I don't think there are clear answers or clear conclusions. I think historians are going to be arguing for a very long time about what we should have done or could have done that would have made this turn out differently. But what we do know now is we've got a major tragedy on our hands in the number of dead and the potential destabilization of an entire region.
Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Martin Smith, frontline producer and reporter. His documentary, Obama at War, airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. If you cry often or feel like you experience emotions a lot more strongly than most people, you're not alone. You might be an HSP or a highly sensitive person.
HSPs are getting attention lately from the scientific community. Earlier this month was the first international scientific conference on high sensitivity that was in Belgium. There's also a documentary coming out this summer about highly sensitive people called Simply Sensitive.
So we decided to see what HSPs are all about, and we're taking your calls. Does this sound like you? Do you think you're a highly sensitive person? Are you relieved to hear there are other people like you out there? Are you close to someone who's an HSP, and how does that affect your relationship? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Elizabeth Bernstein is with us. She's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal and writes the Bonds on Relationships column. Her latest column on highly sensitive people is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Elizabeth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'll start us off with the definition. What is a highly sensitive person, or HSP?
A highly sensitive person is someone who really feels things more deeply than, say, regular people. And so they're feeling both positive and negative emotions more deeply. What they're really doing is their brains are taking in more stimuli. That's what the research is showing.
So what are the common characteristics of someone who has a, well, it's not a has thing, who is a highly sensitive person?
You know, it's somebody who is more empathic, paying closer attention to their environment. Highly sensitive people often can read other people's emotions much better than regular people. Again, they also can get not just highly sensitive to emotions, but to sound, to smell, to a lot of crowds, something, you know, a lot of stimuli going on. Very sensitive to stimuli. They can cry more easily, and then they can sometimes overreact, which is, tough to say, but they can.
And Elizabeth, as I read your reporting, correct me if I'm wrong, this is nature, not nurture. This isn't how we were brought up, how we grew up. This is in our brains.
This is in our brains. So there has been an increasing amount of study, scientific study on this, you know, up to about 100 different studies now on things related to high sensitivity. And it's showing that there's probably a genetic reason for this. And they're starting to isolate the specific genes. One of them is related to serotonin transmission. So how serotonin, which is a hormone that, brain chemical that helps you, helps process sort of emotions in your brain and mood, how that works. And this is related to that. And while it is nature, it is genetic, it's something that if you have a good or bad childhood or a good and bad environment, that will impact you more if you are highly sensitive.
One interesting thing seems to be that it's equally found in men and women, because at first glance it sounds like you're looking at old-fashioned gender stereotypes, you know, of women cries easily, overreacts, but it's men and women.
Exactly. You would think, oh, women would have it more. We have, you know, more hormonal shifts, whatever the stereotype is. But it turns out it's about 20% of the population, and it's equal in men and women. And in fact, since my article ran, I have quite a few men who've written and said, this is me. I'm so glad that I knew it's got a name, actually.
And Mindy on Facebook says, my husband is an HSP. She says, it's hard for men since it's not as socially acceptable to be so moved by people and overwhelmed or otherwise affected by their environment. So because of stereotypes, a woman might be less, I guess, judged for being highly sensitive than a man would.
Exactly. She may be less judged if she's tearing up. Depends on what it is. If she's crying at a movie or, you know, something moved her or upset her, you know, for sure. I think in the workplace, women may be judged harshly for being emotional, though, similarly as men. But, yeah, women can get away with their emotions a little more, which is expected of us.
Now, you've written that there is sort of an HSP moment happening now. I mean, there have been books about it for a long time, but why does it seem to be cresting again?
I think it's the research that's coming out. People, reporters are starting to look at the research. As we mentioned, a documentary maker, even some celebrities are coming out. So in that documentary, Alanis Morissette, the singer, is interviewed, and she says, you know, she's a self-confessed HSP. So people are starting to realize, wow, you know, there is a way that I am, you know, sort of in the world, the way I react to things. It's not depression. This is not depression. This is not introversion. These are not people who just, you know, want to be away from the world. It's something separate. People want to know what it is, and they're starting to look at it.
We're talking to Elizabeth Bernstein from the Wall Street Journal, looking at people who are highly sensitive, HSP, highly sensitive people. You can join in. Is this you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Elizabeth, how does this affect people in relationships? Say where there's one person who is highly sensitive, an HSP, somebody else who isn't.
An HSP, first of all, you need to sort of understand yourself. Some people go through their whole life and wonder, why did I, you know, why was I always sort of oversensitive to things? And, you know, once you finally realize, you know, it's not just me. This is something that other people have too. That's the first thing. But in a relationship, to directly answer your question, you know, if somebody doesn't understand that this is the way you are, they can think, oh, you're just weak. You're, especially if you're a man, right? You're just weak. You're just, you know, being a baby, being a crybaby, whatever. There's a lot of names that could be tagged onto this instead of, you know, you're somebody whose brain is literally processing more information, and that is harder to do.
And while we get some callers on the line, Elizabeth, I'll come clean. I'm an HSP.
You took the quiz.
I took the quiz, as did Rob. And I got, so I think there were, what, 25 questions on it? And if you got more than 14, you were an HSP. I got 22. Rob got
seven. Seven, yeah.
Which makes him an HIP.
HIP, highly insensitive person, we decided, yeah.
But so one question that came to my mind as an HSP, I guess, is that questions of self-care. Do we know about how people who are highly sensitive should take care of themselves and guard when they're being sort of bombarded with stimulation from life every day?
Exactly. So, for example, I mean, to give a little example that this is not like a foo-foo thing, when scientists put people who are HSP, who score very highly on that quiz, they put them in brain scans and they look at their brains are processing more information, especially when they're given emotional cues, when they're shown a picture of, say, a loved one who was smiling or who was unhappy. Their brains are really firing at a higher level. So to sort of understand that, you know, you can't take that much stimulation, you may need a time out for yourself. So you may need to take a break. It could be from work, it could be from colleagues talking to you, a party, a crowd, something like that, but also from highly emotional situations. So if you're in an argument and you know you're highly sensitive, you want to be careful and maybe tell the person you're in this conflict with, you know, I need a little break. I've got to process some things, but I will come back to you soon, you know. So there's that. And then there's the regular things that we all should be doing, but they're very important for HSPs. Sleep, you know, getting a lot of sleep, getting the rest, eating right, exercising, like minimizing stress.
Not to hammer too deeply into central time hosting dynamics here, but if you've got a person like me, low on this scale, person like Veronica, higher on the scale, what do I do? How can I deal with that HSP in a way that respects the need for those breaks you're talking
Great
about?
Great question, Rob.
So it can work.
I'm not saying I'm going to do it.
But it can work great in any kind of partnership, you know, work or home. So you need to sort of understand that Veronica is an HSP. So if you can see her getting overwhelmed, if it's stress, if it's, you know, something, you know, technical issue, something's not going right, you know, you can watch that and maybe step in more quickly, give her a little break, or, you know, try to help if she seems flustered. But on the other side, she's probably going to be more sensitive to callers' questions, to some of the more emotional things there. So she can pick up the slack too in other areas.
All right. Well, good question. We'll see how that plays out. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Bob on the line with us in Portage. Bob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for the topic. I didn't know it was called HSP. I was always more of the, under the study of more of empathic, you know, line of thinking. But I'm a photographer, and I have been for 30 years, and have been battling all kinds of different issues because of the level of sensitivity that you experience when you are a person that processes an entire room, which makes me very good at what I do. But it's also, I am so emotionally drained and with engagement with all these individuals. But without a camera and being able to see the world through, you know, just the viewfinder, which isolates a lot of it, it gives me a lot more insight, but yet still gives me some boundaries.
Okay, Bob, interesting case there, that the camera gives him a little bit of distance. And he's also getting at the yin-yang of this, that there are difficulties, but there's also a lot of benefits that come with being an HSP.
Exactly. And so the researchers also think that there's a number of professions that people who are HSPs really excel at, and they are the empathic professions. So they would make maybe better primary care physicians, but they're going to make better writers, better photographers, as he is, better counselors or teachers. I'd like to say reporters or, you know, talk show hosts. But so there's that. You know, you've got this big edge. He's going to see people for who they really are, and he can see it with or without that camera lens, you know, between him and that person. You know, but the downside is he's really taking in a lot of the a lot of those emotions as well. So again, I guess it goes back to self-care. Like, how do you take care of yourself before and after those experiences where you're working?
We're talking to Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about highly sensitive people, HSPs, the subject of her latest column.
And we're taking your calls. Does this sound familiar to you? Are you an HSP or someone close to you highly sensitive? And what is it like for you navigating the world as a highly sensitive person? Do you think there needs to be more awareness of people who are highly sensitive people? If you're one of these people, call us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. Her latest column is about highly sensitive people, or HSPs. You can find a link to more about HSPs on the Central Time Facebook page.
We want to hear from you. Do you think you might be one of these people we're talking about? How has being highly sensitive affected your life? Is it a relief to know you're not alone? This is a thing? It's in your brain? Good or bad for your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers. Now we have Lisa with us in Richland County. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great topic. I'm listening to your characterization, and you're describing my 7-year-old son absolutely perfectly. So I'm wondering if this is something that can be applied to children.
Uh-huh. What about kids and being an HSP, Elizabeth?
Exactly. So they're seeing that this is starting in childhood, actually, you know, infanthood, and that, you know, goes with the person. Good parenting can help a lot in helping, you know, some of the downsides of it, the crying and overreacting, but it's something that is also being studied in children. And then again, it's pretty steady across your life if you all want.
Lisa, thanks for the call. So how is this diagnosed, Elizabeth? We mentioned a quiz, and people can take that. It's linked from your article, which is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. But is it just that quiz that tells us, or is there more to it?
It is that, and the psychologists who sort of look at this have a more detailed quiz. So, you know, you can go to somebody and get a more detailed quiz. It's not it's not a syndrome, or, you know, it's not actually a diagnosis. It's a personality trait. So that's why it's done with a quiz, and you don't really need a doctor to tell you. You can sort of look at it yourself, and you know how you are. You pretty much know if you are one. I think most people have said when they take the quiz beforehand, they kind of know what they're going to be. But again, this is not something that's a disorder, something that's wrong with you. It's just the way you are. It's something that is an innate personality trait.
We'll go back to our phones now. We have Betsy with us in Fitchburg. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm an occupational therapist, and I've had much experience with sensory processing disorder, and I wonder how that compares to what the guest is talking about.
Okay, so what about overlap, Elizabeth, between sensory processing disorder and being a highly sensitive person?
You know, I haven't looked at that research, so I don't know for sure, but my guess is that there is going to be some overlap or some connection there because, again, this is a part of the brain. These are rewards parts of the brain. These are parts of the brain that process empathy and other emotions that really are overfiring when this is going on, which would be similar in the disorder. So I'm imagining there's some connection to this, also to depression, you know, that there's some overlap in some of these things. But again, they're distinct.
Can I just jump in and point out, though, that it sounds like the depression thing, being an HSP, could be beneficial to you in recovering from depression? Right.
Exactly. So very interesting new study shows that people who are HSP and separately depressed, again, these are separate things, they respond to cognitive behavioral therapy better, probably because they're just emotionally more attuned. It's easier for them to pick up and to react and to do some of the things they're supposed to do in that therapy because they are sort of processing it, you know, at a higher level. So if you are an HSP, therapy works really well for you, even better than if you aren't.
Talking to Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about HSPs, highly sensitive people, and how they interact in their lives with the rest of us on a daily basis. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Ellen in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. There's so much to say. I'm trying to get my life across in a couple of seconds here. Recently, I had a complete breakdown, and I think that all my years being an HSP person along with depression and anxiety really caused that. Now, since that, I have sort of recovered a joy in myself and a joy at discovering how incredibly sensitive I am. It's hard to control sometimes, but what I see, what I hear, what I imagine, how I respond to people's feelings, I love it now.
Ellen, congratulations. I'm glad that you've come out of this in a happy way. Good luck to you in the future. And Elizabeth, that gets to what we were talking about some earlier, that this isn't inherently good or bad. There's nurture in how we deal with being highly sensitive.
Exactly. And so, as we were saying before, you know, good parenting, a good childhood could go a long way to helping somebody who's an HSP sort of learn to cope with those downsides to it better. But also you can nurture yourself as an adult, which sounds like this last guest was, you know, doing. And, you know, you can learn to, as she said, take the joy away from it. If you are empathic, if you see other people's emotions and feel for them more, you know, why not embrace that and find a way to even use that for yourself and others? You could volunteer, you could do art or music, or, you know, there's a lot of ways where this is really a huge plus.
Well, thank you for the call, Ellen. And we go next to Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Hi there.
Yes, good afternoon. I guess I'm an HSP because I feel like the poster child. I think I've been very intuitive my whole life. I have a deep rapport and love for animals and nature and all that. And I also am an artist. And I'm just wondering if those... And I have... Somebody used to tell me that I had the world on my shoulders. And that's exactly how I feel. Everything... And I do. I have so much... I take in so much information with, I notice everything. So I guess I'm pretty much a HSP.
Okay. Jocelyn, thank you so much for that call and raises an interesting point. You know, Elizabeth, are HSPs more likely to be artists?
You know, it's interesting. They're probably more likely to be the good artists. So, because they really are noticing everything. Like she said, she's noticing everything. So an attention to detail and a real intuition for your own feelings and those of others are really going to, it's a beautiful thing for that. So that's, you know, I can see where that's where that part of joy that the previous guest was talking about may come in. When you match that something else that you're really good at that and utilize those qualities.
Jocelyn, thanks for that call. We heard from Gray on Facebook who says, as an HSP, life can get very overwhelming. Have to have rest to keep balance in life. We also, HSPs, have a tendency to freeze instead of fight or flight in all situations. Elizabeth, you mentioned rest being key earlier on. How about that fight or flight response? Is that something we commonly hear about?
You know, I haven't heard that, but, you know, an HSP would know himself very well, so I would never discount it. If that's what he says, you know, it's freezing is, you know, what sort of happens, it's actually probably a good thing because fight or flight, neither one of those is necessarily the best choice in any given situation. So, you know, freezing and waiting and giving yourself some time to think about it, even if you could do that deliberately instead of a freeze that you can't help, but, you know, I'm going to wait this out and think about it for a minute, would be very helpful. That's actually what the therapists say. When you're overwhelmed, you know, wait it out.
Elizabeth, very interesting, and it struck a chord with our listeners. Thanks, as always, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Elizabeth Bernstein. She's a reporter and columnist of the Wall Street Journal who writes the Bonds on Relationships column. Her latest column, one we've been talking about on highly sensitive people, can be found on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can keep sharing your stories and your experiences there while you check out the article.
Fast food restaurants are making the news this week with new versions of their mascots. McDonald's is bringing back the Hamburglar, a live-action guy, not a guy in a puppet costume or whatever it was. And KFC, formerly known as Kentucky Fried Chicken, will have a new Colonel Sanders, played by Daryl Hammond, who used to be on Saturday Night Live.
There's been a lot of response to what we've seen so far. So the Hamburglar, right? He had the big head, like all the old McDonald Land
characters. He dressed in stripes.
Stripes, like everyone who steals stuff, I guess. Now it's a dude. It's a guy, right, with a mask, and he's still has the stripe thing, but there's a backstory. He's a suburban dad, too.
With kids. But yet he still steals stuff. Anyone else see an issue here?
Guess. I mean, this might be some, like when they reboot old comic books and the darker, more, you know, gray area version.
See where you're going with this.
Yeah. So it's like the Dark Knight Returns Hamburglar version where he's like a tortured soul. I don't know. I don't know where they're going with that.
I don't know. And also Colonel Sanders, I mean, he passed away.
Right. There was actually a guy. Yeah.
And so now we've got someone else taking on that role. I don't know.
Yeah.
Nostalgia, I guess.
I don't know. Yeah. And this is all, I guess, in response to losing sales to places like Chipotle and stuff that, as far as I know, don't have mascots to begin with.
Maybe
this is why we're not in marketing. I don't know.